Good morning. I'm Shelley Pack, writer, producer, and star of the film Chasing Molly. You're listening to Too Much Scrolling. See you in the future.
Going for July 16th, 2019. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm astronaut Chip Hessenflut.
Oh, boy. We salute you for your service. We're just a couple of guys sitting around talking about things that are important to us. Hopefully they're important to you. If you need more information, there's so many great ways to find more information. Yes, Chip, you're right. This is the 50th anniversary of the moon landing, July 20th, 1969.
One giant step for mankind, Steve. Over.
You messed up the line almost as well as he did. You know, he messed up that line, right? You know,
no.
The line goes, one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. That's the line.
Yes.
He flubbed the line.
Did he?
He said, one
giant step for man.
He said, one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind. That doesn't make sense. He left out the man.
Okay.
Well, because the meaning was,
man,
this one dude is taking one small step, and that is a giant leap for the race, for the people, for humanity.
Well, I'm going to disagree. Because when he says one small step for man, he's actually representing all humans.
That's so, the second half of the line. One giant leap for mankind.
Well, that's all right.
That's what the line was supposed to be, and he flubbed the line.
Well, but, you know, Steve, he doesn't have people feeding lines in his ear.
Right?
He's not an actor.
No, he is not. This was not on a soundstage. There was no director who came in to, to make
Kubrick,
the movie.
Kubrick didn't
Kubrick
make this happen,
not a
Steve?
Part of this.
You sure?
I am sure of this.
Steve, I've seen all the things.
I have seen as many things as you have, and I am sure of this. Kids, stop asking me. Year in and year out, the moon landing is real, and it was a huge, momentous moment. I was not alive.
Was it one small step for a man?
It was one small step for a man, one giant leap for mankind. Absolutely. I was not alive for this in 1969. Do you have any cultural reference to the moon landing in your lifetime?
Steve, I was asleep. I was a baby.
I know.
Yeah, I have none.
No,
my I guess the space shuttle was something that I was aware of.
Okay, me too.
So
program in general, at that time,
And so we were not part of that. But you know, that certainly was a magical time.
This brings me to my point. My students are going to be the adults who are going to go on to the first trips to Mars.
Sure.
They are going to be the ones. We are training them now for that next giant leap.
Well, when we go to Mars, but part of it is that with technology and movies and stuff like that, a lot of our history or how we do things is sort of in our mind, as in we've seen it before. Will it still have the same, will it resonate that this is such an amazing thing to do?
I think so. I think that there will be a moment where we as a people come together to watch this on TV just like everybody did in 1969. Mm. The world will be watching when the first people step foot on Mars. That's my hope.
And maybe we can meet a Martian.
There you go.
We keep finding water.
Yeah. There might be Martians in it.
Film at 11.
Brings us to our film at 11, our movie of the week. You and I both had a chance to at least get started.
I got started. You completed.
Oh, I finished this on Friday when it came out, sir. Remember 2 weeks ago, we had the 5th anniversary show last week.
Yes.
So we have to go back 2 weeks when we talked about Stranger Things Season 3 coming out on the 4th of July. I said I would be done with it by Friday of that week. Sir, I was done with this show by Friday of that week. I almost got through it in one marathon viewing, but I fell asleep because it was like 11 o'clock at night, and I watched the last two episodes the day after.
Well, good grief, Steve.
I loved it.
I know this is wonderful, because so far, I'm where I've gotten to the part I've gotten into, this has been really a nice setup, and I'm hoping it continues to follow through.
It does.
It does.
It does. Character study. This story is such a great view of that 85 nostalgia, that summer
There's a mall, Steve.
Of 85. That mall is so right on. That is the mall that I was in 1985. That they recreated it so well.
In fact, they probably found a dead mall that was not being
exactly
used.
That's exactly right. Did they? Yes, they did. If you watch our Twitter feed, you'll see all the behind the scenes pictures where somebody snuck in and took pictures of all the set design of this old mall that was dead, and they built this 1985 set on top of it, and it is gorgeous.
Well, gorgeous may not be the word I would describe a mall, but let's just say it is a picture of something in time, Steve.
It is a good set design.
A little glamour shot for you, Steve.
Glamour shots was not in there that I remember, but there was a takeoff on the concept of glamour shots. Yeah,
absolutely.
Where the girls had their day at the mall. What a great story. You haven't gotten all the way through it yet, so we're not going to spoil it. But what a great story. All those relationships are so well put together, and the actors are so good at showing us what they're feeling here.
And one of the wonderful things about it is because it has enough viewers, they've had the budget they need because it is a flagship program.
Right.
And it's got great music, it's got great actors, the story seems to flow real well.
Oh, ladies and gentlemen, I can't tell him anything about the music yet because he hasn't gotten there yet, but you know what I'm talking about when he says the music in this is incredibly important.
All right. Well, there you go.
Oh, you're going to love it.
Well,
hate it.
So far, this is really good. Is anything you want to leave with our listeners?
There's a phone number. If you wanted to make a phone call, you can get a little bit of extra Stranger Things information.
So there's a phone number that's released in the story.
David Harbour released this phone number on his Instagram page, A Piece at a Time. And if you put together all the clues from David Harbour's Instagram page, you can dial this phone number and hear one of the characters from this program explaining a little bit more the mystery.
All right. So we've got that phone number and the link to get it right in our notes.
Yes.
So that's always available to you.
Do you suggest Stranger Things?
Absolutely.
Is there anybody that you would not suggest it to? Is there a group of people that should not be watching this?
Maybe young kids?
Because this season 3 is the grossest, most horror-tied season.
Okay.
There are some really disgusting things that happen in season 3.
It's definitely PG-13.
Uh-huh.
Okay. It's not mature, but if you go down, if you think of like where PG-13 came about because of Raiders of the Lost Ark, the melting face. So it certainly wasn't, it wasn't PG, but it wasn't really R either.
It's just bad enough for me to turn my face away from the screen when the gross things happen. That's the group that I'm concerned about for Stranger Things. But generally speaking, if you've seen enough psychological horror, there's definitely some psychological horror to this. Mm-hmm. And if you've seen enough campy horror, there's definitely some campy moments to this. I love Stranger Things. I can't wait for season 4.
Steve, are there any movies that have Odin's son in them?
Of course there are. Men in Black International came out a few weeks back, and I finally got a chance to see this one. It features Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson. You'll remember that they played Thor and Valkyrie in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So Thor and Valkyrie are back together again.
So Thor and Valkyrie star in this, right? Okay.
And Liam Neeson, he's got a certain set of skills.
He's got some skills, Steve.
And Emma Thompson also makes an appearance in Men in Black International. Yeah, sounds like a great movie, doesn't it?
It does sound like a great movie.
It's not a great movie, Chip.
So this is the story of Well, the secret organization that basically goes out and makes sure the aliens are not doing anything right. bad.
Protecting us from the alien threat. The Men in Black are out there, and you don't know about them because they wipe your memory, but they're protecting you. Don't worry. This group is another squad of people protecting the Earth, and it sounds like this would be just as exciting as the previous Men in Black stories. I enjoy to no end the first Men in Black movie. That is a beautiful movie, well constructed. We get the introduction of this idea through the eyes of the Will Smith character, and the Tommy Lee Jones, you know, gristled old man character is there. Mm-hmm. The second part is just a little bit below the original. This one, I gotta tell you, this was a boring movie.
Well, that's too
like,
bad.
Like, there's aliens and adventure and shooting and toys and guns and all sorts of things happening, and it was boring.
Well, that's too bad, because you have this beautiful cast, and it should be much better than it is.
Yep.
So, Steve, do you have any movies that maybe have Deadpool in them?
Okay, so I know you're going to make fun of me, and it's okay. I saw Pokemon Detective Pikachu, and I enjoyed this film to no end.
Well, Deadpool's in it, Steve.
This is definitely Ryan Reynolds, definitely playing that similar character to Deadpool, a little less foul-mouthed, but he is the voice of Pikachu. You, the main character, the main Pokemon that you probably remember from the last 25 years of Pokemon adventures.
Who is Pikachu? I know Deadpool.
Okay, so when we reviewed Deadpool, we said that Ryan Reynolds was playing basically Bugs Bunny as a superhero, that he's just that quippy, you know, running around doing crazy things character. That is very much what's happening here in Detective Pikachu. He's got so many one-liners. He's just saying these funny things that may not be connected to the storyline at all. It's just Ryan Reynolds.
All right, so tell me, does this movie maybe remind you of some movie in the past?
It does. Remember I said he's playing Bugs Bunny in Deadpool.
Yes.
Well, there is another character that's very similar to Bugs Bunny. That's Roger Rabbit. Detective Pikachu is very much a parallel story to Who Framed Roger Rabbit from the 80s.
Is Jessica Rabbit in this?
There is no love interest for Pikachu.
Were they paying patty cakes, Steve?
God, I love Roger Rabbit. That is a great movie. This is just as good a movie.
Really?
It is parallel to that story. The story of Roger Rabbit is this detective, this washed-up detective, is trying to find out who murdered his brother.
Okay.
In Detective Pikachu, this new young kid, who's not a detective but probably should be, is trying to find out who murdered his father. Very similar. In Roger Rabbit, there's a toon world and a real world, and the two work together. They've always worked together. They don't ask why they work together. They just do. Same thing with this.
She's not bad. She's just drawn that way, Steve.
Again, there's no Jessica Rabbit. I wish that there were. In Detective Pikachu, the Pokemon are just a part of normal life. Everybody walks around and there's Pokemon everywhere. That's just how it has always been, and nobody thinks about it. The Detective Pikachu has the ability to communicate with this kid, and they go on this adventure to find the bad guy to solve this mystery. And Bill Nye, not the science guy, the other Bill Nye, the British Bill Nye, he's Bill Nye the British guy. He's the evil corporation that is in charge.
That sounds very 80s.
It's very 80s. This movie is very 80s. If you enjoyed Who Framed Roger Rabbit, you can live through knowledge.
Is he trying to tear down the community center scene?
I'm not going to answer that question because I don't want to ruin this. You might actually watch this movie.
It does sound like it would be a lot of fun.
The nostalgia here is very similar to the nostalgia that we had watching Who Framed Roger Rabbit.
Okay.
We did not obviously grow up with Pokemon, but that's been around for 25 years. The first Pokemon movie was 20 years ago.
Wow. I remember it like it was yesterday.
You really do.
No, I don't.
You remember when Pokemon was a thing and people were walking around with Pokemon.
Sure, kids did.
Kids.
Yes.
Those kids are 30.
Oh, well, there you go.
Uh-huh. just like we looked at Bugs Bunny in Who Framed Roger Rabbit, went, oh yeah, we know about Bugs Bunny. He's a cultural thing.
Sure.
The kids today might look at Pokemon and go, oh yeah, I remember when Pokemon was a cultural thing, sure, a part of my life. 20 years on, things change. The nostalgia factor is here for those kids, and you can appreciate that nostalgia here.
Okay.
This is a fun adventure. It's a good mystery with some really interesting twists. Just go into it forgetting that it's Pokemon. Think of it as Bugs Bunny and Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and you'll have fun with this one.
Good.
You got a chance to see the Prime Day concert for this year. Amazon's Prime Day started yesterday, still going on today.
Sure, and if you wanted to support the show, you, of course, can go through the Too Much Scrolling.
Amazon.TooMuchScrolling.com.
How lovely. Just try to remember that. That's what I always say.
That's what I always say to you, Chip.
All right, exactly. All right, so Prime Day concert was the kickoff for this. It happened actually last Wednesday, and the person that they hired to headline this was Taylor Swift, which Taylor Swift has a new album coming out in August. This was the launch of her new song, her new single, and you got a whole bunch of songs from her. It's about a two-hour concert, if I remember correctly, where they had four acts, and Taylor Swift was, of course, the prime. They spent a lot of effort on this.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, this is the advertising.
This is good marketing. Absolutely.
And in fact, I immediately, as I was watching this, knowing my oldest daughter loved this, and my youngest daughter liked it too, why isn't Target doing this?
Mm-hmm.
Why isn't Sears doing this, who is in our area? The Amazon certainly knows how to use their resources incredibly well.
I think of those Old Navy commercials where all of those washed up stars were in all of those Old Navy commercials to try to get that hearts and minds of the people who are watching that commercial. Taylor Swift is certainly hearts and minds. You can attach her to Amazon and go.
Well, in fact, you can think of maybe the Super Bowl. Like the halftime show and who they're hiring for that. Maybe on that same level. This was all streaming. And then we had a number of artists that I wasn't really familiar with, but maybe my children were.
Right.
And certainly the production was incredibly high level. I would recommend it. It may be still streaming on there if you go to your Amazon Prime tab. On your either through your computer, or you can watch it through your whatever server. I use an Apple TV, and it's just something to watch. I had it on the background. I thought it was really well done.
Nice.
And they had lots of trivia, and they gave away lots of stuff.
Nice.
It certainly was. It wasn't overdone, but it certainly was done on a very high level. It such a right level of marketing.
All right.
So Steve, we're going to get to my next movie, which is a highly recommended. This is so much fun. Go ahead.
You saw a movie called Swinging Safari. This is an Australian film. It was released in Australia last year. It was released here in June. This features Guy Pearce and Kylie Minogue.
Now, this is called Swinging Safari. It's based off of an album that was released back in the 60s. Or maybe it was released in the early 70s. It's called Swinging Safari. And it is that funny, jazzy type of music that you used to have in the background. But it has this great cast. And this is all about the 1970s.
In Australia.
Well, it doesn't matter if it's Australia.
Uh-huh.
It's the 1970s.
The universal 1970s.
So it's a little bit different because, yes, it is Australia, but it doesn't really matter because it's the 1970s and all those crazy hairstyles, all the crazy clothes that they were wearing, and all the crazy stuff that the kids were doing during that time.
Yeah.
Yes. This was kids basically driving their parents crazy. And this is also parents sort of going through that time. So, you think of this, the sexual revolution of the 60s going through. And in the 70s, yes, they have hey, boys, we've got everything all set up. Have a seat here. And they did have sort of a little soiree that caused all sorts of havoc for their friendship. But it was very, very funny. This is not raunchy. like an American film would, if they made this an American film. But there is something just incredibly like, maybe like the Bad News Bears in the 70s.
Okay.
So something like a little bit on the edge there.
All right.
And of course it ends as all great films end with the 1970s. Do you remember when they blew up the whale that landed in Oregon?
Because there's a beached whale and they don't know what to do with it. So some genius thinks up the idea of putting explosives in it to get rid of this beached whale.
And it happened so long ago that it's not on the forefront of most people's minds. But it, of course, works exactly as you would imagine. It just rains blubber and meat everywhere. And it is hilarious. This is a very fun film. I'll say 75 out of 100, and it is something that I guess if you were an older teen or an adult, certainly you could watch it and have just a lot of fun. A lot of kids making interesting and questionable decisions.
A lot of nostalgia for the 70s built in there too.
But the deal was, as all we've all learned, is we survived the 1970s and all that crazy psychiatric stuff that they kind of threw to us, that we are good people and we survived.
Yeah.
And we wouldn't do that to our kids. That's what we learned, Steve.
The trailer for this is a laugh riot, so I do recommend that you go and at least watch the trailer on this one. I'm going to seek this one out because it seems like you had a lot of fun watching that.
Lots of fun.
There is a documentary on HBO called Student Athlete that is far less fun than A Swinging Safari.
Oh, this is a fascinating film. It came out last year, and it's a documentary on college athletics and basically what builds up to college athletics. So, you know, we think of high school athletics, you can think of youth athletics, and the amount of effort these young people are spending to be, you know, for very few jobs. I think there was 300 people who made it to professional, I can't remember, basketball or football. It doesn't really matter. Within 3 or 4 years, most of them are out of that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
What we talk about is the amount of money that college athletics is generating. And it is a billion-dollar industry, multi-billion-dollar industry, and the NCAA is part of it. And part of it is that they get their labor, which is the student athlete, and that is a term that was specifically designed for these people, to basically
for free
work for, well, they're not working for free,
well,
but they're working for very limited resources.
The exchange for this education was the original intent was, here, I'm going to give you this education, you play this sport, but
the money wasn't anywhere near what it is now. In fact, one of the kids ends up signing, I think, with the University of Kentucky. And they used a formula based on how the NBA divides up their player versus ownership revenue. And his value of playing, they estimated a little bit over $1 million.
Mm.
A little bit. So going to University of Kentucky, they estimated the value of him doing that a little over $1 million. Now, University of Kentucky can turn around and say, well, we've given, not only are you worthy of this, mm-hmm. but we've also given you the platform to get noticed and all this other stuff. While true on some level, Chris Webber, who is a famous guy who played for the University of Michigan, who was not in this, there was a story of him when he didn't have $10 in his pocket.
Mm-hmm.
He's walking by the University of Michigan bookstore, and they're selling his jersey for over $100.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, obviously he felt used. He was a famous basketball player, for those people who don't know that. But this is the story we're following, some of the athletes. There was a gentleman who played for Baylor. He was a football player. He was a walk-on player. Baylor's a very expensive school. It's a private Baptist school down in Texas. And I'm guessing $40,000, $50,000 a year is what it costs to go there. He was couch surfing because he was a walk-on player. He didn't get a scholarship. And one of the parents, who was not affiliated with the university and not affiliated with the athletic department, found out about it and basically had him move into an apartment that immediately made him ineligible. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole bunch of this, terms that are dictated to these students who are unable to produce any type of revenue to support their ability to train themselves. This is by design. This is a very ugly industry. I'm not mm-hmm. saying ugly in the sense, I love college sports
mm-hmm.
and I love sports in general, but it really gets kind of ugly because you start seeing that, first of all, football, I'm not sure why anybody would play football with the amount of knowledge mm-hmm. that we have on the damage. And we're talking about peewee, middle school, move it up to high school, college, and professional. The damage it does to your body, there's really nothing you can do. Your brain was not meant to move that way.
Not to mention your knees and all of your joints. I mean, there's damage to more than just your brain. But yes, your brain is sure. impacted by this.
Well, this is a fascinating story. John Shoup, who was the University of North Carolina's, I think, offensive coordinator when they went through their scandal, and he was also the football coach for Purdue, has become a big advocate for players getting paid mm-hmm. Or getting some kind of stipend.
Right.
And if you're saying, well, then what's the value of the college education? Well, once again, when they're going to school, the idea is that they have to remain eligible. So these many of them are not getting college educations. They're taking classes to remain eligible.
Right.
And so there's a difference in that. While certainly not addressed in the documentary, there are universities out there that have created funds so that if your eligibility has run out and you haven't graduated, you can go back and it will pay for your school. Hmm. But that's still not the norm everywhere.
Right.
You will look at athletics differently after watching this, and you're going to question why they should be part of the universities. I'm not talking hmm. about intramurals. I'm talking about big-time college athletics. Why is this part of the university? And there may be a different way. The European model is they actually have academies or whatever. You go and you go to the athletic association and you play it separate from school. Anyway, fascinating. And let me add one other thing. They bash Enterprise in this, Enterprise rental car in this in a way.
Okay.
And I have a friend of mine who's a recruiter. And if you graduated from college and you cannot find a job, his recommendation to anybody is go work for Enterprise. They will teach you how to run a small business mm-hmm. because they're small offices. They have inventory. There's reports you end up doing. Yeah. They teach you a lot of these skills. And he goes, you come back to him 4 years from now, he can find you another job. So the deal is, this is not founded, and we that's a terrible way of treating Enterprise. Enterprise, by the way, hires a lot of college athletes after they graduate.
Very interesting. Stacy saw something interesting. She wouldn't tell me what it was, so you and I are going to find out together what movie Stacy saw this week.
Excellent.
Hi, guys. This weekend, I watched The Dead Don't Die, the hotly anticipated new zombie film from Jim Jarmusch. It's been on my radar since the first mentions he was doing a zombie flick a few years ago. And after Only Lovers Left Alive was so, so good, I was expecting big things from this. Sadly, it didn't deliver. The story is essentially the planet's axis has tilted due to fracking, and strange things are happening around the world. In the quiet town of Centerville, there are longer days, a lot less nighttime, animal disappearances, and some other things that are getting stranger and worse. Honestly, there isn't really much more to say about the story because that's it on story. There is no more story. Jim might be the king of slow burn films, but without any substance or story to keep pushing it, it becomes kind of a snore fest. There is the very occasional laugh in the film, but it's not enough to save it. And it feels like it isn't even one-dimensional, but actually no-dimensional if that were possible. There's also some very, very bad attempts at being meta that just fall flat on their face, which weirdly are where some of the laughs come from. It's hard to say much more about The Dead Don't Die without breaking the no swearing rule. But in short, it feels like a self-indulgent ego stroke by a director who wants to appear righteous and smart and better than the rest of us. Which we can all probably agree is not the most appealing prospect when you're going to the cinema. Up against the likes of Midsommar or even Annabelle Comes Home, this horror just falls at the starting block. I love zombie films. I love slow burns. I love films that have got a smart message to tell you something to make you think. But I can't stand The Dead Don't Die. If you're interested in hearing any more of my thoughts on films or anything else, be sure to check me out on Twitter, @FilmsWithStacy, where you can also find the link to my website for more in-depth views. Until next time.
Thank you, Stacy. If you want to find out more from Stacy, you can go to her Twitter, FilmsWithStacy, or her Instagram, FilmsWithStacy, and thank you for the fun review. Opening this week, there is a huge live-action animal story called Lion King.
Well, I don't think it's live-action,
Steve. It's not live-action, is
but,
it?
But they call it live-action.
I know.
It is basically...
it's an animated film, but...
That looks live-action.
The animation, we've gotten so much better at animation in the last 100 years that now we can make things look real when they're not real.
And it looks like Darth Vader's back. He's playing his role.
Of course. Of course you have to get James Earl Jones to be the voice of Mufasa. There's nobody else that can do that, just like J.K. Simmons is J. Jonah Jameson. I look forward to this one. I know that it's different.
This is going to be very good.
The one thing I question is why? Why are we doing this? Because we can. Is there a reason to remake this particular film this way?
Well, we have Mulan coming out shortly. They just announced that. Yeah. And we've got other ones coming out shortly, too. So this is part of Disney's way of, I think, maybe keeping their stories relevant. Mm-hmm. You know, Little Mermaid was announced and all that other fun stuff, too.
Yeah, a lot of stories on that this week. There's a movie called Above the Shadows coming out. This is the story of a young woman who is invisible.
All right, so this looks interesting, but this is wild.
It is weird.
It's like Ultimate Fighting is in it. So we have a girl who basically disappears from a family and then finds a person who is an ultimate fighter who can see her. And there's a story going on. This is
weird.
This is interesting and odd at the same time. It's just odd choices of stuff.
And Jim Gaffigan is her dad.
he's a pale guy,
so
Steve.
That's weird. That's a weird one.
That's weird.
There's another one. It's called Into the Ashes. I couldn't tell you after watching this trailer what this movie is.
There is it's a film.
Uh-huh.
And things happen between two guys.
And I'm not even sure what the things are that happen.
And this trailer is probably the worst trailer I've seen in a long time.
Since Aladdin.
So let's just say it's called Into the Ashes, and it's a film.
You can find that in our show notes. There is a superhero movie coming out this week. Do you watch superhero movies?
I think I do, Steve.
Do you like gladiator films?
Do you like films with gladiators? Hey, this is a low-budget film.
Uh-huh.
And it is a film that is making fun of... These are a bunch of retired superheroes.
Uh-huh. 70-year-old actors coming back to play superheroes. This one's called Supervised.
This is called Grumpy Old Superheroes.
Tom Berenger, Bo Bridges, and Louis Gossett Jr. are featured in this one.
This looks interesting. I'm not. I think we're going to have to watch this streaming.
It's another one of those movies that is appealing to a certain age of person, that these 70-year-old actors are out there. Let's get them some work. This might be a very good film. There's a movie called Bottom of the Ninth.
This is a film that looks like it should have been a Rocky type of film.
Uh-huh. From the producers of Creed and Rocky Balboa. Uh-huh.
But it seems to like two-thirds of it was put together. It looks pretty odd.
It is a baseball movie.
It is.
Featuring Joe Manganiello and his wife Sofia Vergara.
Well, there we go. Like I said, maybe it's going to be great, but it looks like to me like it's like two-thirds there. We'll find out.
Yeah. Baseball movie, summertime, maybe it's good. There is a documentary coming out called David Crosby, Remember My Name. The trailer on this one is not a happy story, Chip.
Well, I would say it's a Sony classic, so we know there's a certain decorum that we want to make sure we say when we introduce this.
Really?
Yeah, well, there we go.
Okay.
The other part about this is, I think this should be renamed David Crosby, I Apologize.
The Apology Tour?
Yes.
It seems like he's not been a nice guy for most of his life, and he has some regrets.
Well, he's in his mid-70s, and he certainly loves performing, but no one loves being around performing with him anymore. He seemed to have severed a lot of
he's burned
ties.
A lot of bridges in his time, and that's the trailer here is a very sad story about a very talented guy who had a hard time communicating with people.
I'm sorry.
The I'm Sorry Tour, David Crosby, Remember My Name.
Book it. Book it.
Brings us to our book it, our book of the week. You got a chance. This is like the sixth week in a row that you've chosen the book. I want you to know that.
I walk a lot of miles, Steve. I walk a lot of miles. I'm walking about 50, 60 miles a week.
I've read books too.
You have.
we'll get to some of mine later.
Well, you'll have to put a book in there.
You got a chance to take one of the great courses. This is called How Colors Affect You, What Science Reveals. This is put out by Professor William Lidwell, who was at the University of Houston.
Yeah, he seems to have left that position. He actually is either creative director or working with a company right now. And this is his expertise, colors. Okay. And so,
colors.
So this is the story of colors, how you see colors and how to use colors and all that other fun stuff that you probably have interest in, but never really sat down and went through any formal training on
this. Okay, so tell me about color and how it affects us. Colors can change our way of thinking, right?
That's right. They absolutely can. In fact, if you've got light bulbs in your home, there's a good way of describing it. In the morning time, if you want to feel more energized, think of what sunlight does. And there's a blue hue to that. And you can feel energized and creative and all that. But at night, your natural rhythm is fire, right? That's where you're going to get light. So you use a warmer light. The blues go away and the reds and the oranges and yellows come in. And all of a sudden, your rhythm, your natural rhythm. So if I wanted to create an environment that worked to your natural rhythm, that's the way I could use light to do this. And colors, as we quickly learn, are basically when you see something, the absent, basically they're absorbing every color but the one you're seeing.
They're reflecting into your
eye. So it's actually an anti-color.
Yeah, my students would tell you all about this because this is part of my starting lecture for every one of my classes is explaining about colors and how, yes, green grass isn't really green. It looks green because it's absorbing all the other colors and reflecting green into your eye. Yes, sir.
Well, there you go. So we're working off Steve's course. In fact, you could teach this course now.
A great course.
Well, around the world and how humans view colors is very similar. We have a lot of similarities. But a lot of things, how we look at colors has been trained. And that's one of the things that is a revelation on this, is that some cultures cannot see certain colors because they were never introduced to them as like this is a separate color.
Uh-huh.
So blues and greens for some areas are one color.
They can't identify the difference between those two radiation fields.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
Okay, and here in the U.S., if we haven't been taught and given the words to do it, we can't distinguish certain colors either.
One of the things that blows my students' mind is when I say, this is green, because we've all agreed that the word for this is green, but you have no idea what this looks like to me. My perception of this radiation field and your perception might be very different, but we have been given the word green to describe it. You can't describe it any other way. You don't have another word to describe this color.
And so colors are introduced naturally in all cultures a certain way. So if we had to say, okay, and in fact, that's how the course is broken out. We are introduced to colors as humans have learned to describe them and expanded our views of colors. So initially we start off with black and white because every culture distinguishes black and white. So you can think of night and day as a good way of describing that.
Mm-hmm.
So every culture has black and white in them. The third color that's introduced to you is red. And so red is the color of blood. So every culture has red. And these colors provoke different emotions to you. So if you were wearing a tie of a certain color, if you wanted to make people feel more secure, if you wanted people to feel more cutting edge, this is exactly how the course is divided. So once we learn what the color is, he's going to tell you a little bit about the history of it, and then also how to use that color to best basically articulate what you're trying to do with that color. And immediately you're thinking like, oh, my classroom should be a certain color.
Uh-huh.
My business should have these colors in it. I should not wear this color if I'm trying to use this. You know, light blue shirts work real well if you're looking for trustworthiness.
Right.
Okay, but it may not be the right color to use in other situations.
Mm-hmm.
I highly recommend this. This certainly wasn't a very long course. I think it was like a 5-hour course, maybe a 6-hour course.
Okay.
fantastic. Really worth my time just basically learning how to use color and basically the theory behind it.
And how color has been used to manipulate you in marketing. When there's a certain color, you get a certain feeling from it. You said blue is kind of a calming, I believe you a little bit more when you're wearing blue. Red is a very bold color.
In fact, the light blue across across the world is a very calming color for every culture. So men and women, except for male Italians.
Interesting.
Male Italians.
Why would that be?
Well, because their football team wears the, which is their soccer team, wears light blue.
And it pumps them up.
It pumps them up.
Everybody else is very calm.
Isn't that amazing?
That is interesting.
But so that means that we can be trained to look at colors and see colors. Mm-hmm. Well, let me give one more statement on that. If our local high school is purple and white, and if we decide that we need a boost for this big game because this big game is coming, and we decide all wear red jerseys, it may give us a temporary boost. It wouldn't be long term, but for a temporary time, it may make a difference on how we perform.
Interesting.
There's another part that the studies talk about. If you want to look more aggressive, you wear black. If you want to look more submissive, you wear white. And so, you know, home teams in sporting events wear white. And teams that wear black get penalized more. And so there's all sorts of stuff that goes on to how putting together, like, team uniforms, how you want to look. If your team's not, you know, playing too safe, it's white, maybe it's time to bring out the black uniforms.
Nice.
There is real good information on how to use. I'm using it on team uniforms, but it's on anything. Business envelopes, on how you should paint your office. It could be on anything. What your house should be,
your walls,
your bedroom,
anything
like that.
All of that. Interesting psychological theory of why we react to different colors. That is called How Colors Affect You, What Science Reveals. It's one of those great courses. You can go to greatcourses.com or you can go to our Amazon store, amazon.toomuchscrolling.com.
Appetite.
Chip, do you hear that?
Listen, I haven't heard the appetite sound for a long, long time.
Brings us to our appetite, our app of the week, which we haven't done in, it's probably been a year since we had an appetite, but I had to bring that sound effect out this week because this week we got a new app. It is Dr. Mario World. It is available for the iOS and Android mobile platforms. It is the next game from Nintendo.
Well, so Nintendo, for those who live under a rock, is basically the family-friendly game system, and they develop a lot of beautiful games.
And they keep their hardware and software together, very much like Apple does. They don't share their intellectual property very often with other platforms, but this week, my Android phone from Google, I've been playing Dr. Mario World.
So tell me about Dr. Mario World.
It's a nostalgia trip. This is one of the games that came out for the original Nintendo Entertainment System.
Really?
So in the late 80s, my sister and I played the heck out of Dr. Mario. This is a puzzle game, very, very similar to Tetris. And it's also very similar to a lot of those puzzle games that people are playing on mobile nowadays.
Okay.
Those very addictive, candy-crushing sort of games. This is that game. It works so well on the mobile. I'm surprised that it took this long for Nintendo to release it.
So it works well on the Google, Steve?
It works well on the Google, works well on the Apple. Yeah. All of your mobile devices, you can be playing this Nintendo game almost as much as I did this week.
Well, Steve, you spent a lot of time. And
it's a part-time job.
How many levels have you got?
I have finished 60 levels of this game, Chip.
There you go. So, Steve, this sounds like what we know about Nintendo is they're always family-friendly.
This is
And this is like the type of... I'm so sad that they don't release more of these games.
I really expected by this time for Nintendo to have at least released one Zelda-based mobile game. Mm-hmm. It is surprising to me that they haven't, that they're keeping their intellectual property so close to the vest. They want us to go out and buy the new Nintendo Switch that they released this mm-hmm. week, and I look at it and I go, meh, I don't really need another device in my pocket. I have a device that is fully capable of playing these games. Give me this software. I will give you money for this software.
So this is a game you would recommend?
I absolutely recommend this. If you have a lot of time, if it's July and you don't have an actual job, teacher, sorry, if you have 30 days before you have to go back to work and you have a part-time spot in your life where you want to play a puzzle game, this is a fun puzzle game. I love Dr. Mario. I texted my sister the moment that I heard this announcement. I said, Diane, you have to get this game. And she went, oh, this game. I've played this game for so long. I love it. Dr. Mario World, that's our appetite, our app of the week.
Scroll with it.
You know, we went to Wisconsin Comic Con weeks ago now, and we still have so many great interviews.
We had a wonderful interview with Bob Camp. Bob Camp is one of the artists that developed Ren and Stimpy.
One of the co-creators of the Ren and Stimpy show. Yes, sir.
And so let's go to it right now.
Fantastic work. So this is Bob Camp. You are the co-creator of the Ren and Stimpy show, right?
That's correct, yeah.
So I love the Ren and Stimpy. I love the comedy. I love the drawing. So where's your part in this? Were you the idea guy?
In a lot of ways, yeah, but I didn't create the characters. They were created by a guy named John Crisfalusi, and we had a small studio, which was basically just me and him and Lynn Naylor and Jim Smith, called Spumco, and we were pitching shows around, and John pitched a show to Nickelodeon called Your Gang, which was a parody of Our Gang, like Little Rascals.
Yeah.
And it was just a lot of characters, kind of a big overblown thing. And there were two minor characters, a dog and a cat, Ren and Stimpy. And Vanessa Coffey, who was the producer who convinced Nickelodeon to give people like us a chance to make cartoons. She said, look, let's just do the dog and the cat, make a cartoon about them. I like them. And so that's what we did. They gave us the money to make a pilot, which ran in the Spike and Mike Twisted Animation Festival in theaters all over the country to huge acclaim, and we got picked up for a series, and next thing you know, we're making cartoons. But it's kind of like Seinfeld, you know, how like him and his buddy are pitching a TV show and there's no idea, there's no concept. Yes. That's Ren and Stimpy had no concept at all. Other than the characters and their relationship.
Okay.
You know, they're kind of like Bert and Ernie, only weirder. Yeah, you know.
Well, and in fact, there was sort of a revolution in cartooning at the time, because it really was kind of out there as far as the experiences they had.
I think we were part of a bigger revolution. I think, you know, you can't ignore The Simpsons, and they were there a little before us. Beavis and Butthead, you know, and then shows that followed. And we were a lot of people. There was a lot of people in the business who were kind of sick of doing toy-based shows and stupid superheroes or whatever, and they wanted to do shows that were really funny. And we all grew up watching Looney Tunes and Tex Avery and cartoons like that, and you know, like Yogi Bear, things like that. And that's what inspired us. We wanted to make cartoons that were genuinely funny. I was a huge Bullwinkle fan, you know, and the absurdist humor in that really appealed to me. I grew up reading Mad Magazine.
I still have a subscription.
Yeah.
Mad Magazine still comes to my house every month.
That's right. And I was influenced a lot by underground comics.
Yes.
When I was a kid, I hung out in the local head shop reading like Zap comics and, you know, like Abby Hoffman, Steal This Book, and all kinds of subversive hippie literature. And National Lampoon. So I think a lot of other people like me were seeing and experiencing all that same stuff and wanted to make cartoons, but wanted to make cartoons for us.
Yes.
You know, like people sometimes ask, like, how can you make a cartoon like this for kids? It's like, screw kids. I didn't make this cartoon for kids. I made it for me. You know, I made the cartoon I wanted to see. You know, I don't want to dumb down anything for anybody with some kind of preconceived notion of what they should or shouldn't watch. that's mind control. I'm not into that. I'm into making honest humor, and you know, people like stuff that's different. They like stuff that's exciting, that blows their mind, you know.
Well, it wasn't dirty, but there was always something like going on there, kind of.
But that's life. That's life. I mean, you look at Bugs Bunny. Bugs Bunny's in drag half the time,
exactly.
Coming on to Elmer Fudd. You know, that's adult stuff. You know, Friz Freleng said, I don't make cartoons for kids. I make cartoons for adults. And Friz Freleng is one of my gods, you know, and that's the way to think. Because if you look at cartooning, up until TV came around, cartoons were theatrically produced films for general audiences, for everybody. And the kid, the parents bought the tickets to those cartoons. They didn't aim programming at kids back then. Now everything's aimed at kids. You know, so the kids are in charge, you know, of all media, you know, which I think is ridiculous. So I'm not into talking down to kids. I'm not into producing content specifically for kids, because you immediately come with this baggage, which is psychologists and network executives and stuff who are deciding what is or isn't appropriate for kids. And I don't think life is appropriate for kids, you know? It's like, it's okay to have a president who is a serial liar, you know, but heaven forbid a kid should see a dirty joke, you know? And,
It wasn't dirty. It was just sort of like, it was definitely, as a college student during that time,
yes.
Certainly we were drinking it in.
We were the kings of innuendo.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know? And I think the later Ren and Stimpy's missed that, the ones I had nothing to do with. I think that they were beating people over the head with the sexuality and all that kind of stuff, which, no, sir, I don't like it.
So let me ask you a little bit about SpongeBob, because that seems to be like a natural legacy of maybe what Ren and Stimpy set out to be.
And Vincent Waller is one of the executive producers on the show. He worked on Ren and Stimpy. He was a director on Ren and Stimpy. In fact, he directed Rubber Nipple Salesman, which is one of the weirdest things I've ever had anything to do with, you know. So there's a lot of DNA in SpongeBob from Ren and Stimpy.
And you're there doing some SpongeBob work now.
Yeah, in fact, these are some character designs I've done for the show recently, actual pencil drawings. Actually done with a real pencil, an ancient tool used by prehistoric cartoonists, you know, back before the digital age. There was the Bronze Age and the pencil age. Now we have the digital age. I worked on the last movie doing character layouts. I've done a couple of storyboards last year, and I've just been helping directing a show recently for them, so I'm working with them a lot.
So let's go back to when, all right, so this was a big revolution. Simpsons came out, Ren and Stimpy, Beavis and Butthead.
Yeah.
You basically described that we were dealing with, tired of doing cartoons with G.I. Joes and the Transformers and stuff. This was sort of a revolution in styles. Were you doing all the work in-house? Were you guys...
A lot of it. More than a lot of studios. We were doing character layout, which is basically a breakdown of the key poses in an animated scene. Mm-hmm. Okay? So if you have somebody reacting to something, and somebody punching somebody, and somebody, you know, beginning to run out the door, or whatever they're doing... In the storyboard, you're going to get a limited representation of those actions, and then there's a stage, or there used to be a stage back when cartoons were done, like for Warner Brothers, like Termite Terrace, those kind of cartoons, theatrical cartoons. They would do layouts, which were animators would do clean key drawings for a scene, and then the animators would take that and fill in the gaps, you know. So we did layout, which a lot of studios didn't do. So we had writers, story artists, and layout artists. So we did do a lot of layout. But generally, most of the lion's share of work in TV cartoons are done in Korea or some foreign country. Yeah.
And Ren and Stimpy was also known for sort of innovative deep coloring, I would say.
Oh, we had a great, great paint crew run by the great Bill Ray, or William Ray, as he's known. We had great painters, and Scott Wills and other painters on the show are now tops in the industry and production designers, and they're great, yeah.
And this was before the big renaissance, I guess, with the computer animation, Tell me, what do you see the difference between, say, the new computer and animation styles versus what the styles that you guys were doing as pencil and ink?
I think there's a lot of good animation being done now. Sure. And there's no clear delineation between computer and non-computer animation now, because if somebody says, you know, I'm doing it 100% analog, they're liars.
Okay.
Nobody's painting animation cells anymore. That's a part that's gone with the horse and the buggy. All the color in every cartoon is done digitally. You know, the storyboards are 99.9% done in Toon Boom Storyboard Pro, which is a vector-based program. So computers and animation are one thing. Some are less than others, some are more than others, but computers are a part of it and always will be as long as they're making cartoons. I mean, it's like if you watch a modern movie, any one of the Marvel movies, 70% of it is animated.
Right. Sure.
By animators, like
yeah.
real animators,
right.
and not live action at all. So you could say it's an animated movie with live action bits.
Right.
You know? So I don't think that there's... The definitions don't work anymore. Traditional
right.
versus computer, it's all the same.
So where do you think animation is going to go from here? You talked a little bit about Marvel, and we talked a little
you
bit
know,
about...
If you're not familiar with this, you should check it out. There's a company, I think this is the future of animation. It seems to be to me now anyway, I could be wrong, because stuff keeps changing. The way to make cartoons keeps changing, the pipelines for the work keeps changing, the ways to distribute it keep changing. There's a company called Elation, which is run by a woman named Marge Dean, who was actually the studio manager on Ren and Stimpy, the shows we made at Games Animation. For Nickelodeon, and she's a big shot in the animation industry and a top woman animation person that is just doing great stuff. But anyway, she's running the company, and they have distribution through your mobile apps.
Okay.
So you subscribe to their service, and they have licensed lots of cartoons that they stream, and they're creating new cartoons based on these licenses that they're getting. They have two networks. One is called Crunchyroll,
yeah.
and the other one's called Verve, VRV.
Okay.
And Verve is specifically anime.
Okay.
They do anime stuff. But they're picking up lots of licenses. They looked into doing Ren and Stimpy, and they tried to get the license for Ren and Stimpy, but Nickelodeon these days is really, really not touching Ren and Stimpy.
Huh.
You know, Ren and Stimpy's got cooties, you know, and they don't want to touch Ren and Stimpy. They're merchandising the hell out of Ren and Stimpy now, but if you try to get a license to animate it or something like that, it's a no-go.
And where would our listeners find out more information about your current projects and what you're currently doing?
You can come to our Facebook page. It's called Bob Lab, B-O-B-L-A-B Studios. It's just fun to say Bob Lab, Bob Lab. But that's our little company, and we're on Facebook. Check us out at Bob Lab.
Wonderful.
And you can see what we're doing. We're doing a lot of Comic Cons. I'm, of course, doing freelance work these days for Nickelodeon on SpongeBob. Bouncing around, doing different stuff.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you.
That was so much fun. It was so great to talk to him, to hear those stories of that time putting together Ren and Stimpy. Thank you, Bob Camp, and thank you for Ren and Stimpy. Happy, happy, joy, joy.
Good morning. This is Professor Pamela Bedore here to introduce Too Much Scrolling's next Read Together assignment. Join Steve, Chip, and me in reading 1 Second After by William Fortune. It's a story of struggle and survival after an EMP disrupts all electronics and plunges America into a new age of working together without the aid of technology. What would your day look like if you had no access to electricity? Read 1 Second After and find out. We will discuss it on August 13th, just as Steve's students report back for school. Find your copy today and take the journey with us. You won't regret it. I'm Pamela Bedore, and I'll see you in the future.
Thank you, Professor Bedore, for introducing our next read together, 1 Second After. Boy, this book, Chip. Have you started reading this book?
I have not, but I'm getting ready to. It's ready. It's on my Kindle.
Oh, boy. Everybody's got 30 days to read this book. Yeah, be prepared is what I can tell you. Be prepared because you need to think about the issues of EMP, and this story is a great way to get started. I don't know, Chip. I think we have enough information to survive another week. What do
only
you think?
If we can come back next week, Steve!
I think we can. Thank you again to our guests, Bob Camp, the co-creator of Ren and Stimpy, and Professor Pamela Bedore for introducing our next read together 1 second after. Get that book and start reading it. We're going to talk about it in 30 days. 30 days, everyone. 30 days of summer left. If you need more information, give us a call or a text. Our phone number is 805-4104-TMS. Our website is TooMuchScrolling.com. Our email is TooMuchScrolling@gmail.com. We're on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We're on the Apple Podcast app and Stitcher and TuneIn Radio and Spotify. Yes, I know we're on Spotify, kids. You can also ask your smart speaker to play the latest episode of Too Much Scrolling. I want to thank you again for listening to Too Much Scrolling. I'm Steve Fodor.
And I'm astronaut Chip Essenflow.
We'll see you in the future.